pricing for 2020 on Premier? What are you hearing?
I'm hearing anything between 10% up to 100% up. The difference being 10% up is for the UK market and 100% up is for the Hong Kong market. Not exactly that. There are one or two people who are repositioning, but apart from that, between 10 and 25% is the most typical. And I think it's the guys who are already expensive will probably go up by more, and the guys who have tried to keep their prices fair will go up by less. So, you know, philosophical thing. But the problem is there is no wine to be had anywhere. Everybody has bought up everything thus far. Wow. And the growers keep saying they get people coming knocking on their doors saying, well, I just desperately need to get your wine. I don't mind what price I pay. It's not healthy. It's not a great lookout for the future. The other thing that's happening is that with the incredibly high prices being paid for bits of vineyard land, the French government officials have just been sending around letters to anybody who has transferred the succession plan. Normally, before you're somewhere between 60 and 70, you transfer the vineyards to the next generation. And that there is then a calculation of what tax you should pay on that. And it's based around the sort of the value of the wine. But the tax authorities are now saying it needs to be based around the selling price of the vineyards. And we will take as our guide for that the last transaction. And given that a whole load of Grand Crus have been selling for sort of north of 50 million euros per hectare, suddenly anybody and the authorities have the right to backdate for 3 years. So anybody over the last 3 years who has passed their vineyards on to their children and paid what they thought to be the correct amount of tax is suddenly being hit. They're suddenly getting a letter saying, and we want another million euros from you. You know, which is a complete disaster. And if that continues, then it's going to be the end of sort of local ownership because people simply won't be able to afford to pass it on.
Wow.
So it's definitely a worrying moment. The other thing which is crazy is why are people paying ever more high prices for the land when its ongoing value is in doubt? Because if global warming does get any worse, then it is quite possible that Pinot Noir is no longer going to enjoy itself in the great vineyards, possibly not even Chardonnay. And equally, there are a lot of the vines which are dying because the vine rootstock can't cope with the hot, dry conditions. So it is really a moment of a little bit of doubt as to the long-term future. So to pay some prices which are ludicrously higher than anybody's ever paid before seems to me to be nuts. So,
wow. Interesting.
So don't do it, guys. The next time somebody comes to you with a proposition, could you just help me out and buy me a hectare of Musigny? Think twice.
Oh, my. What was the last transaction in Musigny? Was it the Faverley?
In Musigny, probably the Faverley one. But there have been little bits of Bonmar, a bit of Clos Saint-Denis, tiny bits just changed hands, whole load of Griot Chambertin. So to give you an indication, the previous rate for that was sort of set for the taxation was 293,000 euros per ouvre, and some has just sold for 2 million euros. So you've basically multiplied by 8. So if you paid a tax bill of 200,000 or something like that, they might hit you for an uplift of, well, they might change it to 1.6 million. You know, and some of these guys have earned a fair amount of money from what they're doing, but that takes it to a different scale. So who we're missing? Richard. We're missing who else?
Brian. Two Brians.
Right. Two Brians and a Richard. is that for the current exchange rate? Richard. Right, so we have got today 16 wines. So the order that I put them in is we've got a trio of 2017s to kick off. And then we'll look at a trio of Richard Chambertin, then a couple of Claude Saint-Jacques, and by then I will leave you for your dinner. So Sebastian is passing around the Richard, and I gather everything was in good condition, which is nice. Incidentally, you guys probably haven't been tucking into 2017s very much. It's only when you try and drink in a bone restaurant you have to have 17s because it's the oldest wine on the list. I'm pleased to say I had a delicious dinner on Saturday with Mr. Moore, formerly of Hong Kong.
Yeah,
Neil, Alex, and he sprung for a bottle of La Tache 17, which was really very, very happy to be drunk. It wasn't too closed at all. It was a beautiful bottle. But they've already got on the wine list at that restaurant their Russos, including Chambertin and Clos de Bears, are 2019. Being proposed to drink in a restaurant. I think that is a great shame.
Love them, yeah.
Yeah.
What do they charge for the 19s at the restaurant?
1,300, 1,500 in euros.
That's a good price.
But that's a lot.
It is. I mean,
4 or 5 years ago, which probably was 700 or 800.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically what the restaurants here tend to do is that they put on a standard, quite high markup, but they don't take into account the fact that there could be a secondary market price, which is a lot higher still. Some of them, as we discovered once when Feng and Crystal were in town and said, let's go out and have lunch together. We went to what should have been a good restaurant, but almost all the good wines on the list said en vieillissement, so waiting in the cellar for aging, which is translated as, if you're local, you'll see that on the list and order it up for next time you're there. But if you're coming in from out of town, we don't want you to plunder all our best bottles, which I found very interesting. And I haven't been back to that restaurant since. And what's worse, Crystal got stung by a wasp. So we definitely didn't go back to that restaurant.
So, Jasmine,
okay.
What do you think price that... The restaurant got it sold for. Is it like probably now 500 euros that they're being sold it for, and therefore they're selling it for 1,300? Or
no, I think they'd be paying quite a lot less than that.
Right.
Yeah, I think they might be in the sort of 300-ish range, but I'm guessing.
Oh my God! Buy a restaurant.
It really was not long ago that. We were buying Chambertin from under 100 euros from the domain, Mary's. And then it went up. Yeah, I mean, probably the 2014s, 2013s, 2014s would have been under 100 at the time. But of course, the restaurants have neither the place nor necessarily the funding to store it. So anyway.
So, Jeff, if you decide to open a restaurant, we'll fund you.
There is something I heard, and I can't remember which grower. It might have been Arnaud Lachaud, but if you wanted to get the top wines as a restaurant, in order to get your next shipment, you know, they'd sell you six bottles, but you had to produce the six corks of the bottles that have been opened in order to get the next six.
Oh, that's very smart.
Very smart, which means that they've all got to be drunk in the restaurant, and you can't, you can't then flip them on the secondary market for a fortune. I mean, it's really sad that it's necessary, but it makes sense. Because in times gone past, there were three-star Michelin restaurants who would be selling a lot of their allocation in that form. Greetings, Richard.
Hi, Casper. Apologies.
That's all right. No worries.
What have I missed?
We're just waiting for you.
The decision was made that we decided what would be the three best bottles, and they've already been poured and drunk. But we're starting with the three 2017s. So, I mean, I think you all know the story about 2017. It was the biggest crop for quite a while, and there certainly hasn't been anything the same size since in Reds. But it was a warm summer, not as hot as some of the subsequent ones, and not quite as dry. So everything ripened cheerfully. And the size of the crop just means that these wines are really accessible. They don't have quite the same precision and quite the same depth as the truly great vintages, but we don't need every single vintage to be great. We just need to have wines to drink as well. I know you guys are lucky enough to have plenty of more mature vintages, and I'm sure you'll be encouraging a few more American collectors to decide that they need to retire or sell their cellars, stock up a bit more. But anyway, so you've got 1, 2, 3, Ruchot Chambertin, Chambertin Clos de Bears, and Chambertin. I put them in that order, but nowadays, with Suriel in charge of the tastings, they always taste the Chambertin before the Clos de Bears. But I decided to leave it that way around once the wines are got a few years' age. She also is a huge fan of the Ruchot Chambertin, as am I. Maybe if you just, while I'm chatting away about this, that, and the other, if you make sure you taste those three so that then we can talk about them, you've already got them tasted and on board. But one of the things that Russo has got that keeps it at the top of the pack, ahead of challengers like Du Rocher and the Dugas and so on, is that they have big land holdings. So for example, of these three, Ruchot Chambertin, they've got a hectare, which I think makes them the biggest. Chambertin, it's 2.5 hectares, and Clos de Bears, it's 1.5 hectares. So there's only when Trappe and Rossignol Trappe were together, they were more, but in Chambertin, and possibly Pierre Demoir is more in Clos de Bears. But basically, Russo, like DRC, they're fortunate enough to have the biggest holdings in a lot of the vineyards that they own. It's interesting. We're going to go on doing it on a few occasions. Yeah, so afterwards, with 2011, you'll have Clos de Bears and Chambertin side by side. 2001, you'll have the same. 1998 and 96, different vintages, but you got the two together. And I think it's really, really interesting because it is not a slam dunk necessarily as to which is the greater vineyard. I'm just checking. Yes, in Clos de Bears, it's definitely Demoir first, then Drouin La Rose, then Russo. And in Chambertin, nowadays, it's Russo first, then Trappe and Rossignol Trappe and Camus. But having just recommended that people shouldn't buy vineyards, there are rumours getting stronger that Domaine Camus, it's high time that came up for sale, because they've got such a lot of great vineyards and they make wine so appallingly badly. It would be a shame if it didn't get sold, or at least the vineyards rented out. They've got 1.7 hectares of Chambertin, 3 hectares of Charme, nearly 4 hectares of Mazoyer, 1.5 of Latricia Chambertin, and a bit of Mazzy Chambertin. And fortunately, these days, almost all their grapes are going elsewhere rather than being turned into wine at the Domaine. Anyway, we're not here to talk about Camus. We're here to talk about Russo. So Ruchot, this is a plot, the Clos de Ruchot. Originally, Russo in 1977, they bought that and a bit more, and then they decided it was too much, more than they needed. So they kept the walled bit called the Clos de Ruchot, and they sold on to Minoret Gibourg, for example, and to Monsieur Bonnefond, the rest of the Ruchot that they had. So Monsieur Bonnefond gave his to the Rumiers to look after, first of all Jean-Marie and then Christophe. And that plot has actually been sold to another investor, but at least for the foreseeable future will stay with Christophe. And there's a further plot of Ruchot, the bit that Fred Esmonin has been making, that has also been sold. That's been sold to LVMH, i.e. Clos de Lombre. And as from 2021, Clos de Lombre will make part of it and Fred Esmonin will keep part of it until he gets to retirement age, and then it will all go to Lombre. So there are lots of changes happening at the moment. And I can't remember when we last saw each other and when we spoke, but also Charles Van Kennet of Hudelot Noela has taken on a huge number of vineyards, which used to be either sharecropped or rented by Laurent Ponceau, by Amélie Berthaud, and by Domaine René Leclerc. So it's what was the Domaine de Chezeau of the Mercier family. That's been sold up and has gone to Domaine Hudelot Noela. But it's not quite clear if the previous people will be able to keep some of it to go on making.
Oh, another big transaction.
Anyway, so...
In Russia, there's also Henri Magnien.
He has a small bit of Ruchot. He's a very good grower.
And
Marchand Griot has a tiny amount. but miniature. But I mean, the three big ones of quality are the obviously Rumier, Murier Gibourg, and Arousse. And it's absolutely Cyriel's favorite, and I do love it. It's so delicate. It's got there's something in line with Echezeaux insofar as that it's not a great big blockbuster of a Ruchot. It is all about the elegance and the detail. But you should get lots of little flavors moving across the tongue. And they replanted a bit in 2003, which Cyriel thinks, rather than damaging it, having younger vines, has actually been a benefit. I don't know what the quality of the old vines were like, but the balance between having a substantial number of old vines and some younger ones, she thinks has sort of given the vineyard a little bit more life. So for me, it's now definitely number four in the hierarchy behind the three long established big names. If we talk a little bit about the background, of course, Armand Rousseau, the chap who set it all up, and then Charles Rousseau, born in 1923 and died just, 2016, something like that, sort of great advanced age. And it was the transition from Armand to Charles was quite straightforward because Armand was either killed or badly damaged in a car accident, and Charles basically got control from the end of the 50s. But it was a little bit difficult between Charles and Eric. Eric, who's exactly my age, he was having difficulties that his father would never really let him take over. So he sort of forced to ban him from the actual winery. And it's gone much, much better between Eric and his second daughter, Cyriel. He's got two daughters, one born in 86, one in 88. And Cyriel is the one who is taken on. It doesn't really matter whether it's Eric or Cyriel in charge. They're not planning to change things. It's pretty much seamless. Eric didn't change that much in how his father made the wine. He did much improve what was going on in vineyards. And in particular, he took more care with all the vineyards. So I think from Eric's time onwards, the sort of other Grand Crus and a couple of Premier Crus and the Village Chivray started looking a lot smarter than they had before. And in fact, in 2020 vintage, I was knocked sideways even by the Village Chivray from Rousseau, I thought was absolutely brilliant. By the time you get to the top end, one or two of the vineyards were getting a little bit high in ripeness and alcohol. I think Clos La Roche came in at 15 and was a bit marked by it. Some of the other Grand Crus at 14.5. And interestingly, I thought the Chambertin coped with that and the Clos La Bears slightly less well, just to give you a fast forward. So between the Chambertin and the Clos La Bears, most people, you are so experienced with them, I'm not going to be telling you anything new, but the marketplace slightly puts Chambertin ahead of Clos La Bears, and there's a feeling that it ought to be the more senior. Sometimes you hear that the Rousseaus think that the Clos La Bears is the better wine, but I think that's probably them just pushing back against the concept that the Chambertin must be the better. I think when they're young, the Clos La Bears is a more supple, more immediately friendly wine. Normally, whenever I've drunk them side by side with age, I've tended to prefer the Chambertin, but other palates may differ.
Well, we did that side-by-side tasting last year.
Yeah.
And?
And I think we did think Clos La Bears more elegant.
Yeah.
Accessible younger, but, long-term, Chambertin a bit more pet.
Yeah. I think there's just a little bit more structure in the Chambertin. It's sort of, I get a similar parallel between Bâtard Maraîcher and Bienvenu Bâtard Maraîcher. There it's a little bit clearer from where the vines are on the slope, but the Bâtard, it's understandable that that has a bit more depth and power. But when they're young wines, I'd probably rather drink the Bienvenu. In the case of Chambertin and Clos La Bears, there isn't that much difference because they're side by side. Chambertin de Bears possibly pushes back a little bit further up the slope. There's a little bit more marl in the Clos La Bears, so white marl. I don't know that I get a complete consistency from all the people who make both. I definitely found there was a similar profile in all the cellars with both that I tasted 2020, that the Clos de Beers seemed to have taken the heat more than the Chambertin had done. But
who else makes Dujac Chambertin is best?
Right? It's both. He has both. Dujac have 0.05 of Chambertin and 0.24 of Beers, so it is more of Beers, but they make them together. They've actually changed that. Now they are doing a famage, a rental, whereas initially they were doing a sharecropping. So now it's sort of money that changes hands rather than wine that changes hands with the owner of that plot.
Somebody told me that recently prices have flipped around between the Beers and the Chambertin. The Beers in more recent vintages might be actually more expensive than the Chambertin. I don't know.
In what's happening in the marketplace, I mean, they'll be the same price from the Domaine, I'm pretty sure. They always were. I don't think that will have changed. But afterwards, you're probably more up on market prices. I care about what the wine tastes like, and I leave it to you to play around with to make the market in some cases. Anyway, Michael, do you have a view on difference in pricing at the moment between the two?
I've just been shocked by how much the prices have risen in the secondary markets, especially for Russo.
Yeah.
Like 17s, they are more expensive than 13, 14, 7, right?
Yeah.
And actually, you're now starting to hit, what is it, north of £3,000 per bottle for these?
For 17.
No, for like any kind of Chambertin or all the
best. But do you see any difference in pricing between the two vineyards now?
There is a bit, but I agree with Greg's point that I think there's such a desire for fine wine or premium wines that the pricing has moved up so much that it's hard to keep track. As is just like moving in such a strong direction, right?
You should have checked the market at the beginning of this evening's session and check it again at the end and see if there's a change. The other factor, of course, is that they do have approximately twice as much of the Chambertin that they have of the Clos de Beers.
Beers is half what they have of Chambertin.
Touch more than half, but yes, approximately. The only thing I would say is that their Chambertin holdings sort of start at the road, Route des Grands Crus, and go up the hill, up to the forest, whereas their Clos de Beers tend to be higher. They've got more than one parcel of it, plot of it, but they tend to be a little bit higher on the slope. Horses, courses. Right, so you tell me, of the three wines in front of you, tell me how they're showing.
I love the best.
The best is a standard.
Yeah. Okay. There's more there.
Lovely.
And more expressive. Yeah. Like more just coming out at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, obviously, the Ruchot, the other two are going to have sufficient more weight to them than the Ruchot is going to have. But I hope that nonetheless that it's still showing a real class and elegance.
Yes. Agree with that.
I'm a Chambertin prefer. So this great surprise.
Super. Right.
Totally. Oh, that's good. Yeah, good to know. I'm just having a look at my notes. And all right. Well, from September 2021, the 17th, that would have been our Bergfest tasting when we're tasting blind. I definitely got a better result out of the Chambertin over the Clos de Beers on that occasion. So what in fact we found that maybe the bottle was a little bit faulty because it was rich with a little bit of caramel to the nose, rather heady, high toned, slightly varnished tannins. So maybe that bottle was not pristine. because the Schombatar was in much classier form. I mean, they were both very nice, but neither truly outstanding. We weren't in my five-star territory. And the Ruchot I've only tasted in barrel. It wasn't part of that Bergfest tasting. But I'm just looking at my scores then. I gave it 94 to 97 as the bracket, as the barrel tasting.
Yeah.
That's 15 shots.
You may have already been asked.
Yep.
Here's my note from Barrel. Between the Clos de Bears and the Chambertin, she gave them the same score. I said, Cyril prefers to serve the Clos de Bears last, as she finds the oak effect a bit stronger and the fruit is darker. Richer, more concentrated purple, density is immediately apparent. More robust personality than the Chambertin. Amazing length of dark raspberry fruit. Black cherries too. Just about kept fresh enough by the acidity. It may have a fraction more intensity than the Chambertin this year. So, though I gave them the same score, it looks as though I maybe fractionally preferred it, but only by a tiny amount. So, are you moving on to the three Ruchots now, or are you?
Yeah, it's just boring now.
Yeah.
The 15 is spectacular.
1507 and 1999, right. So the 15 will have got the younger vines in, the other two won't.
Right.
But I think it's also quite fun. I felt that rather than just going through everything in vintage order, it was more fun to have comparative flights. And to see three ages of Ruchot is lovely. So, well, you all know, I mean, enough about the vintages. Of 15, I'm expecting to be too young, but 7 should be perfectly drinking, but on the lighter side.
Beautiful nose to the 7.
Yeah?
Well, I'm not drinking the 7 yet.
Yeah.
7 doesn't
have the that's clean too. Oh, that's great.
The 99 is also very good.
Played 3-1-3. So the 7's held up well, very attractive bouquet. I imagine it's the least density of the three. But
pretty aromatic,
beautiful.
And how's the 99? Because 99 is now really, I think, just beginning to enter a probably ideal drinking. I've had a couple beginning to go over the top.
Very productive.
You smell the Clos Saint Jacques 13.
The 99 is a bit shut.
You've got the next two, have you? You've got the two Clos Saint Jacques as well.
They're coming up. Boring now.
Right, okay. So, the 99 Ruchot compared to the other two, as good or not quite so good?
Really good.
Wow. The shot, yeah, it's not. So I think the 15 still the exuberance of the fruit. The 07 is like cool enough, leafiness.
Yeah. I love it. Good. The 99, that's good. The only vintage when tasting in barrel from Rousseau I didn't especially like, and you haven't got any today, is 2009. It was the one where I felt the heat had slightly got there. Now, maybe that they've moved on the viticulture. But I think they have coped a little bit better with the last three hot years. There was also a moment when it was fashionable to say that Rousseau wasn't as good as it used to be, but I have to admit that from my own experience, I haven't seen that. But it is a style of such elegance, really, that potentially hot vintages may not be the friends. They've just built themselves a new cellar, I mean, a cuvery rather, and extended the cellar underneath. It's very nice. They haven't changed anything. Exactly the same format as before. They just have a little bit more space to work in and one or two little tweaks. So it's easier to get the grapes up into the vats than it was before. But they're not really trying to change their techniques in any way. I think they've got a good recipe and planning to stick with it. Okay, I shall need to leave you in a few minutes. So you've got the two Clos Saint Jacques. I'm sure I don't need to tell you about the Clos Saint Jacques. They have the southernmost parcel. Like everybody, it goes from the bottom to the top. They've got a little bit more of the bottom ground, because it's not a straightforward square or rectangle. It sort of slides away. But that is neither a plus point nor a minus point, I would suggest. They resisted all temptation to try and make micro cuvées within Clos Saint-Jacques, and I applaud them for doing that. Because it's the three separate soil types that really make this vineyard happen, and which everybody can do. And here again, as with the Rouchotte, but earlier, when they bought it, when old man Russo bought it, was told by his wife that it was too much and he couldn't have that much. So he sold the 1 hectare to his hunting and shooting friend, who was the ancestor of Fourier. So that's why Fourier had the plot next door. So, as you know, Clos Saint-Jacques, it was always regarded as number three, and then fourth equal were Rouchotte, Chambertin, or Clos de la Roche. I do so love that Rouchotte, Chambertin, but Clos Saint-Jacques from Rousseau has its very special place. I do think Fourier is brilliant. I think Bruno Clair can sometimes be as good, but not consistently so. And then I think there's a little bit of a gap further back to the rest of the field, i.e. Esvenard and Chateau.
Gaffer?
Yeah.
Rousseau is a low stem regime, but not zero.
Yeah, no, more or less no stem. Cyril said they do sometimes put just a few in just for really sort of physically, but I mean, effectively it's no stem. Yeah. And that, and they,
in a vintage like 13, they would have included a bit of stems?
In 13, no.
Oh, okay.
No. You might include stems in the hot years, but not in 13, which was a very, 13 was an October vintage. I mean, that would have been picked around 8th, 10th of October. Which is extraordinary when you think of it today. We're going to have the Chambertin 13 the other night, but we felt after the Latache 17 that it wouldn't have made sense if we didn't have it. So last time, the 13, have I tasted the 13? I don't think I've tasted the 13 recently, I must admit. When I last tasted the 2005, I said, try again in 2025. you're a little bit ahead. I'm just checking. I don't think I have tasted the 2013. At least I haven't got a note on it. How are they showing?
Great. They're absolutely great.
Yeah.
You know what's striking is the consistency that we've had so far. It's just stunning. Nothing you can say is rubbish.
But don't you think it's also vintage kind of
character? Yes.
As you take the 99 versus the 07.
There's no heavy hand in the winemaking, right?
But the point is, they make everything in exactly the same way every year, which means the vintage character comes through. And a lot of other people try and compensate for the vintage. So, you know, if it's a year with strong tannins, they extract hardly anything. If it's a year with hardly any tannins, they extract a bit more. And as a result of which, you get a slightly more standardized result, which, you know, may or may not be what you want. So Rousseau just saying, you know, we grow the grapes properly, we make the wine the same way, and then it will be what it will be of that year. Yeah. And well done to them for doing so. Is the 05 accessible, or is it still saying I'm much too young?
It's accessible, but it really needs
time. It can take time, but it's you can see the magic.
We've now covered all the different vineyards that you're going to be drinking tonight, and in common with other occasions, I will leave you to enjoy the remaining bottles over dinner and relax with them. But is there anything else you'd like to ask either about what we've had or what you're about to have?
Can I ask a question about the ones we're not having?
Right, yes.
I know we're obviously the top stuff here, but equally, I've always liked Clos de la Roche, for example.
Yep.
Maybe the Charm and the Mazzy, maybe a little bit more consistent in my experience. But just interested to hear your views on some of those. And even frankly, the Village Chevrolet, I've really always enjoyed too.
Yeah, no, I think the Village Chevrolet, since the time that Eric took over, has become quite a lot better. And these days, I think it's an exciting wine, and presumably you can pick it up for not too much money. Neither of the Premier Crus get talked about. The other Premier Crus, Lavo Saint-Jacques and Castillet, get talked about very much. Claude Laroche has definitely got a following. But it does always amuse me that if you think of sort of two people coming to Burgundy, they knew a bit about wine. They'd heard a bit about the hierarchy of the vineyards. And one of them went and tasted at Ponceau and one of them tasted at Rousseau. The guy who goes to Ponceau is going to say Claude Laroche is a way better vineyard than Chambertin. And obviously the other way around at Rousseau. So it's a pretty good wine. It doesn't have quite the structure and depth to go on for a long time. But I put it as number five in the hierarchy behind the Clos des Ruchotts and sort of the big three. I've hardly ever actually sat and drunk a bottle of Messy Chambertin, I don't think. From Rousseau. I mean, it's one of their smaller holdings. They've only got half a hectare. Do you guys see it very often?
Yeah, I don't see it very often.
We don't. No. Yeah. I've had it once or twice, and it's always pleasant, well made, yeah. But it's not spectacular.
It'd be fun to do a Messy Chambertin evening on one occasion, because I think there are several really quite smart wines in Messy, and just to see where it stacks up in the hierarchy. But yeah.
Jasper, your top three ranking for Chambertin in general? 1, 2, 3?
Who are the top three producers?
Well, I mean, there's not really much point in going beyond Rousseau, is there? I don't know, but... certainly top one. Dujac is, I mean, there's so little of it, one hardly ever sees it. So I don't really count it, because in fact both that and the Romane Saint Vivant, the American owners said, look, just don't sell it. The very first vintage, I think they offered some to various agents around the world, but they stopped after that. Trappe and Rossignol Trappe I like a great deal, but probably when either of them is at their very best, Trappe might go a little bit further. You have more experience than with Leroy than me, but obviously Leroy's got to be considered up there. I don't think so. You've got Rousseau, you've got Leroy, and then probably Trappe at third. I'm just running my Dini Morte. It's tiny, but of course it's very good. Had a lovely tasting with them. UGP is so tiny. Someone else who's not much known about, because it's quite recent and he's based in Pommard, but Launay Orio are making brilliant wines in the last few years. Their 2019s were absolutely breathtaking. 2020, you might have picked a touch too late, but they're breathtaking. And somebody else to follow, it's not there yet, but there's a change of generation and a partial change of ownership, but Roboso definitely is worth having on your radar.
Nice.
So those would be the main contenders for Chambertin, and in Claude de Mez, Pierre de Moir is worth looking at. He sells his grapes to a lot of people. Favoli is very, very good, and with their special cuvée as well. But I don't think there's anyone to touch Rousseau. Oh, Groffier would be up there as well. On the top of the Clos des Bears. Their vineyard is incredibly, it's over 100 years old, so that helps. Okay, guys, I wish you all I don't have to wish you Christmas yet, because I'll see you again on the 23rd, but for those who aren't going to be here for that, I'll wish you a happy Christmas now, and have a wonderful rest of your dinner.
Thank you, Jasper. Thank you.